Most microbial evolution experiments do not involve gene exchange. In fact, gene exchange typically is excluded from these experiments because it's a complication. This creates a situation where the degree of evolution that can occur in the laboratory can pale to a large degree to what you can see in the wild. Of course, in the wild, you have huge volumes, you have large amounts of time, you have great heterogeneity, but you also have this potential for seemingly good species that you would expect to not be exchanging genes between each other, to in fact be exchanging genes among microbial organisms. And as a consequence, microbes have a flexibility in their evolution that can be rather dramatic, particularly in comparison to the degree of flexibility that we're used to when thinking about, for example, the evolution of modern animals. So this chapter creates kind of a bookend to the previous chapter in completing the introduction to what microorganisms and microbial evolution is all about in talking about gene exchange. Okay, so gene exchange. So this is an overview figure that I published in 2009 that basically attempts to take you through every possible kind of gene exchange that's out there. There are actually a few more than what's shown here, but these are the basics of how gene exchange occurs. So these are our three domains: bacteria, archaea, and eukarya. Consistently, we see conjugation. Certainly among the prokaryotes, we see transduction, which is virus-mediated gene exchange between organisms. And we also see transformation. Transformation is best understood among the bacteria. And that's the picking up of naked DNA. Conjugation is the movement of plasmids between cells. And as noted, transduction is movement of DNA via viruses. Now, the organisms that are cellular contribute in the course of their lysis and deterioration to a free DNA pool that's out there in the world. It turns out to be a rather substantial pool that a surprising amount of information can be drawn from. If you've got an organism living in an environment, chances are some of its DNA has made it into this free DNA pool. And this DNA pool is available to, for example, bacteria in the course of what's known as transformation. But not all bacteria are capable of displaying natural transformation. That is, not all bacteria are competent. All organisms have viruses, and these viruses are free of the organisms in most cases, and they are also, to a surprisingly large extent, able to incorporate DNA from their host cells into their own genomes. And then these viruses are able to travel between cells. In fact, it's their job to travel between cells. And when they do so, they carry nucleic acid from cell to cell, including the some nucleic acid that has its origins in the host cells. Now, the viruses are not that good at traveling between the different domains, specifically in terms of their ability to infect cells that are members of different domains. So a bacterial virus is unlikely to be able to productively infect an archaean. However, the ability of a virus simply to adsorb to a cell is sufficient for that virus to be able to get its nucleic acid into a cell. Of course, this doesn't mean that you're still going to be able to broach the barriers between bacteria and the archaea. On the other hand, the eukaryotes are able to phagocytize, and when they phagocytize, they take up, including the food that they're consuming, any kinds of viruses, such as bacteriophages or archaeal viruses, that may be associated with that food. And when they take up those viruses or that food or even these other cells, what happens is that the DNA associated with these various entities finds its way into a compartment found within the cytoplasm of the eukaryotic cell. Now, these compartments occasionally break, and when they do, they spill their contents into the cytoplasm of the cell, and this provides an opportunity for DNA to potentially migrate into the nucleus and then become incorporated into the genome of the eukaryotic cells, the nuclear genome of the eukaryotic cells. This process is known as you are what you eat. And it basically says that if you've got a phagocytic eukaryotic cell, such as a protozoan, and it is capable of taking up food from its environment, which is what phagocytosis does, some of that food will have DNA in it, and there's a small but real chance, finite chance, that that DNA will be able to find its way into the nucleus of the eukaryotic cell. And as a consequence, eukaryotic cells have this additional means by which they're able to acquire genes, DNA, from other organisms. In addition to this, endosymbiosis, now endosymbiosis does occur in prokaryotes to a small degree, but it occurs to a large extent in eukaryotic cells. With endosymbiosis, you have a new organism that is entering into the cytoplasm of the eukaryotic cell. This new organism has the potential to also burst accidentally and release its DNA into the cytoplasm of the eukaryotic cell. And when that happens, that DNA can find its way into the nucleus and become incorporated into the nuclear genome of the eukaryotic cell. In fact, one of the things that happens over the long term with endosymbiosis is that the genes belonging to the endosymbiont, such as a mitochondrion, migrate into the genome, the nuclear genome of the host eukaryotic cell. And in fact, the proteins that are associated with the mitochondria end up being controlled, produced not by mitochondrial genes, but instead by nuclear genes. And all of this is just another process by which there's a movement of DNA from the environment into the nucleus of eukaryotic cells. There is, to some degree, free DNA that's taken up. The biggest barriers to movement of DNA really is in terms of host range of viruses, as well as host range associated with the conjugation of plasmids. These viruses, however, especially the bacteriophages, are able to move very large amounts of DNA between organisms, and as particularly between different bacteria, and as a consequence, there is a potential for transfer of very large amounts of DNA from bacterium to bacterium, and this gives rise to this potential for bacteria to have these very large genomic islands, such as pathogenicity islands, that can be transferred en masse between bacteria and provide the recipient bacteria with substantial amounts of new properties, such as converting relatively benign bacteria into bacteria that instead have some potential to display pathogenesis. So this is the big picture with regard to horizontal gene transfer, with the gene exchange, particularly between different lineages, between different species. Every one of these horizontal lines is horizontal gene transfer. The vertical lines, of course, are vertical inheritance. And this is a macro evolutionary view of the biological world, where you're looking at the creation of new species. They're not really showing extinctions here, but it's the divergence of organisms. And horizontal gene transfer played huge roles in this process of divergence of organisms. You see here, as part of this horizontal gene transfer, the origin of mitochondria in eukaryotes and the origin of plastids in certain eukaryotes, the algae. These horizontal gene steps, horizontal gene transfer steps, are also endosymbiotic events. Endosymbiosis is another means of horizontal gene transfer. In fact, if you think about bacteriophages as being able to transfer 50,000 bases of DNA in one fell swoop, well, in an endosymbiotic event, you've got the potential for 5 million base pairs to be transferred. It doesn't happen instantaneously where all of that DNA becomes incorporated into the recipient's genome, but nevertheless, all those genes in one fell swoop are moved from outside of an organism to inside of an organism. When a proto-eukaryote acquired the mitochondria, it acquired all of the genes that were associated with that mitochondria, all of the functions that were associated with that mitochondria. And as a consequence, the eukaryote was able to obtain numerous functions that otherwise it wouldn't have be privy to. And in addition to that, there was movement of genes from the proto-mitochondrion into the nuclear genome, and that DNA could be used not just to power or run the mitochondrion, but also for other processes inside of the eukaryotic cell. So the key thing about horizontal gene transfer is not that it happens by any one particular mechanism, but instead it's a means by which material, genetic material that has evolved in one system can move into another system and essentially provide its evolved function or a function that can be derived from that evolved function in the new organism. And as a consequence, an organism is not limited just to its own mutational events in order to create genetic variation. Instead, genetic variation can be supplied from other organisms as well. This is literally migration in the Hardy-Weinberg sense, although rather than talking about migration occurring within a species but between different populations of the same species, instead we're referring to migration that occurs between different populations where each of those populations consists of a different species. So these again are the three domains: bacteria, archaea, and eukaryotes or eukarya. They all presumably came from some ancestor, which can be described as the universal ancestor. And what we're seeing with these horizontal lines here is horizontal gene transfer, such as between the archaea and the bacteria, as being depicted in these various lines. What we're seeing here are depictions of more ancient or very ancient horizontal gene transfer. In fact, this horizontal gene transfer occurred before the origin of the mitochondria. And then you still have recent horizontal gene transfer. In fact, the evolution of pathogens seems to, in part, be a function of horizontal gene transfer, such as the pathogenicity islands that can be moved between different types of bacteria. And then, even given this increase in complication over the standard universal tree, you still have a depiction here that is far too simple. The degree of horizontal gene transfer that goes on is immensely larger than what is depicted here. I mean, basically, they're showing here for the eukaryotes, except for very early on, just these two horizontal gene transfer events. But that's not the case at all, especially with the microbial eukaryotes. There's a huge amount of horizontal gene transfer that occurs. And in fact, even with the animals and the plants and the fungi, you still have horizontal gene transfer, not just via the mating between individuals that consists of different species and the resulting introgression, but because of a potential for viruses to move between species and carry with them, at the minimum, their own genetic material, the viral genetic material, but also potentially genetic material from these other species that they were infecting as well. So horizontal gene transfer, it tends to be much, much more immense in its impact, in the degree to which it occurs, than can possibly be captured in depictions such as this, even though with these depictions there's at least an attempt to incorporate some horizontal gene transfer. It doesn't go nearly far enough to give a sense of just how hugely important horizontal gene transfer is, particularly in terms of microbial evolution. So again, we saw in the Passage Through Time chapter, we looked at various kinds of evolution that can occur particularly in the absence of horizontal gene transfer. In the earlier chapters, we talked about microbial evolution and evolution more generally. A huge aspect of microbial evolution that truly deserves its own chapter based upon its importance in microbial evolution is this horizontal gene transfer, this ability to take evolved genes, DNA, whole metabolic pathways, whole islands, and pick them up in one fell swoop and remove them from one organism and pass them to a second organism, where they may very well enter that second organism and provide essentially the same functions in the new organism as they did in the old. We're used to thinking about these ideas in terms of the movement of the horizontal gene transfer of antibiotic resistance between bacteria, which is important as well. But horizontal gene transfer goes way beyond that in terms of the evolution of bacteria, the evolution of bacterial pathogens, and the evolution of microorganisms generally. So what exactly is sex and what exactly is horizontal gene exchange? So basically, these are sexual processes. Sexual processes are where you have genetic material that comes from one individual and finds its way into another individual. And we can describe these sexual processes as occurring by basically two distinct routes. One of these routes is where you have a more or less equal contribution by both parents to the genetic material of an offspring. This is the typical sexual cycle as you see, for example, in animals and plants. This typically is associated with meiosis, and it's not going to be our primary emphasis here. The second type of sexual process or gene exchange is where you have an unequal contribution of what are actually relatively small amounts of genetic material to one individual, such as to a bacterium. When this occurs, you have various mechanisms by which the genetic material finds its way into the recipient organism, the recipient cell, and then typically you have some kind of genetic recombination that results in the incorporation of that material into the genome of the recipient cell. I say typically because we also have the acquisition of endosymbionts, which really is a kind of gene exchange, but it's difficult to argue that that really is a form of genetic recombination. So even in eukaryotic cycles, the syngamy or fertilization may or may not be followed by mitosis. And it may or may not be obligately reproductive, so particularly in microorganisms, but also in fungi, you have a getting together of genomes in a fertilization step to form a diploid organism, and then that diploid organism goes through meiosis, creating haploid organisms without with haploid cells, without mitosis intervening between the fertilization and the meiosis step. And so therefore, that's really not reproduction in the sense that we are creating a diploid organism, such as an animal or a plant. Although it is reproduction in the sense that if you're starting with two haploid nuclei, you have fusion to form the diploid, and then in the end, after meiosis, you have four haploid cells or nuclei. It is a form of reproduction. But nevertheless, this getting together for sexual processes, even in eukaryotes, is not necessarily reproductive in the same way that we think about sexual reproduction as we see among, for example, plants and animals. And so sex among the prokaryotes usually, if not always, is not reproductive. It is reproductive in the sense that in order for a sexual process to make it to the next generation, there ultimately has to be reproduction. But there really is a distinction between the acquisition of the genetic material from another organism and the actual reproductive step. There isn't this timed setup where when you have reproduction, when you have gene exchange occurring, it's inevitably tied directly to a reproductive process in the prokaryotic organisms. With viruses, you often, in fact, do have sex and reproduction occurring at the same time. The viruses, however, are not obligately sexual. So this is unlike, for example, most animals, which not only is the reproductive step and the horizontal, not the horizontal, the sexual step linked together, but in order to have reproduction, you have to have sex. In viruses, very often the virus is just fine infecting a cell on its own, but it's also possible for a cell to be infected by two viruses, and in the process, these two infecting viruses can exchange genetic material, and thus you have viral sex that occurs in association with viral reproduction. But also there are processes that where you can have horizontal gene exchange between viruses that are not sexual or not reproductive in the sense that the organism necessarily that is delivering the DNA reproduces, or nor the organism that is receiving the DNA immediately reproduces. And an example of this is where you have exchange of DNA between a prophage and a phage that's otherwise infecting a cell, where the phage that's infecting the cell the non-prophage actually doesn't end up reproducing, and the prophage doesn't actually reproduce immediately following the sexual process either, although it will end up reproducing when the cell that it's infecting ultimately reproduces. So there is in viruses often an association between sex and reproduction, but it's not always seen as an association between the two. When you have plasmids, you have a sexual process that doesn't involve the molecular recombination, the crossing over of DNA into the host genome. In this case, the plasmid ends up as an extra chromosomal genetic element. It stays, for the most part, in the cytoplasm, and it's a form of genetic recombination, but it's not a form of recombination in the same sense of two pieces of DNA recombining into a single piece of DNA. And then in viruses, you've got all sorts of mechanisms of genetic exchange depending upon the virus. You have this molecular recombination or crossing over, and you also can have reassortment, and to a degree you can have both mechanisms going on. Often in the viruses that undergo reassortment, the RNA viruses such as the influenza virus, genetic recombination typically involves reassortment rather than crossing over, but to a minor degree, crossing over can go on in these RNA viruses as well. So this graph is trying to provide you with a sense of the degree of promiscuity that you see in terms of sexual processes among, for example, bacteria or viruses. In comparison to the degree that you see, for example, among animals. For the most part, when animals display sexual processes, they're having these sexual processes in association with other organisms that are members of the same species. And this, to a large extent, is because when you have these sexual processes in the higher eukaryotes, a great deal of DNA is exchanged, and the consequences of that exchange are rather important. So the consequences are the reproduction of the organism, and the amount of DNA that exchanges is roughly half of the genome. So this means that if there are genetic incompatibilities between the DNA coming from each parent, they're going to become very much known with a high likelihood because so much DNA is being intermingled. And also the cost of having this intermingling going wrong is that you lose the progeny, because the progeny won't develop, therefore. When you've got this kind of exchange going on, you've got organisms that are mating usually within species, but when they're mating between species, it results in a hybridization event. And the reason why species tend to remain species and not intermingle their DNA is that these hybridization events, where again you're mixing large amounts of DNA, often result in a progeny that either are not viable or are not terribly functional or not as fit as their parents. In other words, there tends to be selection against the hybridization events. And this, to a large extent, is a consequence, the selection and the strength of it is a consequence of the degree to which the DNA intermingles in the sexual processes, such as between animals, and also the fact that the animal is investing all of its reproduction in in the sexual process, because the sexual process is required prior to reproduction. So when all of this is going on, the animals end up being rather conservative in who they're willing to have sex with and therefore reproduce with, and therefore sex tends to be within the species rather than between species. Now with bacteria, sex is a much rarer event and the amount of DNA that's transferred is much smaller. And although an organism may lose its functionality as a consequence of this gene exchange, the degree to which an individual, for example, bacterium can reproduce anyway is just a doubling. It's able to make a copy of itself. And in fact, with a horizontal gene exchange, in bacteria, it may be that one of the copies is the wild type and the other copy represents the recombinant type. So the amount of progeny lost as a consequence of horizontal gene exchange is much lower. The amount of DNA that is transferred is much smaller, and therefore the potential for incompatibilities is smaller. And as a consequence, what you see with bacteria is a much greater amount of promiscuity with regard to what kinds of species bacteria are able to and willing to and able to successfully have sexual exchanges with, horizontal gene exchange with. In fact, we describe the sexual processes in bacteria as horizontal gene exchange, where to a lesser extent we describe those that occur, for example, with animals as horizontal gene exchange. So bacteria are much more likely to have sex with other species and incorporate DNA from other species. When they have sex, the process is not nearly as complicated as it is in the higher eukaryotes, such as animals, and the consequence of the sexual process is not reproduction in the sense that reproduction is obligately sexual, but instead it's the generation of a single hybrid organism, which then in an unassociated process can then go on to reproduce. So much greater promiscuity is seen with the bacteria, and therefore the potential for experimentation in terms of sexual processes tends to be much greater among the bacteria. And this is one reason why horizontal gene transfer is so important in terms of bacterial evolution. It's a way of taking information that evolved in a completely separate lineage, bringing it in intact into a new lineage where it then can do similar things in that new lineage and provide the recipient bacteria with an ability to do new processes. So this business of horizontal gene transfer is something that in the beginning probably was something that happened all the time. In fact, if we go back far enough in time, genes were probably not very big. The entire genetic material probably consisted of individual genes, and a phenotype probably was the result of individual genes that happened to be mixed together in a small environment. That either have some product that can be shared among the different gene snippets that make up this group of genes that have been thrown together. Or alternatively, the genes themselves may carry both genotype and phenotype simultaneously, as you see with the intricate folding of RNA molecules even today. And so you've got these genes, and the genes are kind of exuding phenotype, and phenotype isn't very well protected. Other genes are able to some degree to partake of that phenotype. This means that the benefit to the producer of a phenotype is not as great in the sense that it is diluted out by other organisms partaking of the phenotype, either stealing the phenotype or simply benefiting from the phenotype and thus potentially being better competitors as a consequence. So the beginning of life presumably involved a lot of phenotype sharing between individual genes. This would be a barrier-free world. You can think of these genes and the phenotype essentially as not existing within cell membranes, within membranes. It's difficult to contain phenotype, or at least products of phenotype, if phenotype is separate from the genotype in these circumstances. And again, as a consequence, there's a great potential for phenotype sharing. You also, the sharing results in the potential for, in a sense, stealing of phenotypes, and you can think of the first parasites as being stealers of the phenotypes produced by other genes, or in fact, parasites might have existed that parasitized in some manner on the genotype itself. So either they might have preyed upon that genotype, otherwise, it's possible that they somehow use the genotype to replicate themselves by inserting into the genotype. Who knows? The point is that when you don't have barriers, it's like not having doors on your house. Anybody can walk in and partake of your stuff. So in the top here is we have basically genotype existing within a barrier-free world. The arrows represent phenotypes, so you've got phenotype basically either interacting with other genotypes or alternatively potentially diffusing away from genotype. So full access of phenotype to the genomic environment, so in other words, there's no barriers keeping it from doing stuff away from the genotype, but also there's no means of protecting that phenotype from exploitation by other individuals. And to the extent other individuals are exploiting your phenotype, that means you're not getting the full benefit necessarily from that phenotype, and the result is that your fitness will not be as great, presumably. So as a consequence of all of these things, there was an advantage to having barriers around one's genotype. And with those barriers came some protection of genotype, presumably, resulted in protection of phenotype, although now if you needed to have phenotype that went beyond these barriers, you had to have a mechanism that allowed the phenotype to get beyond these barriers. But some other genotype, in order to partake of a genotype, would have to get through these barriers. Now, these barriers presumably also played some role in limiting the potential for whatever the nutrients that the genotype was utilizing to get to the genotype and its phenotype. So barriers, they presumably provided protection. They inhibited the ability of phenotype to diffuse away from genotype, but at the same time, they presumably changed the way that these proto-organisms did whatever they did in order to obtain resources, because at a minimum, those resources presumably had to cross these barriers. Nevertheless, we see barriers abounding today. Barriers turned out to be the way to go so far as life was concerned, and we see particularly the cell membrane that serves as a barrier that defines essentially what a cell is, and we also see all sorts of barriers associated with multicellular organisms. And barriers, too, of the capsids of viruses that serve to protect the nucleic acid of a virus. So this is another representation of this idea of genotype that's surrounded by some kind of barrier. The barrier is being shown here as a lipid bilayer, but wasn't necessarily a lipid bilayer. Here we have some manifestation of phenotype, and so we're able to keep phenotype and genotype in approximately the same location. This whole proto-organism can be described as a protobiont. And so this is keeping one's phenotype to oneself, and you therefore also have protection against parasites. But you also, as a consequence of this, have a limitation, not only in the potential perhaps to acquire nutrients, but also in terms of the sharing of genotype. So there are reasons why organisms develop these barriers around their genotype. They're probably good reasons. They may not have had to do with preventing the sharing of genotype between organisms. That would be essentially sexual processes. But if we went from a world in which there were no barriers, then in a sense, sex was rampant. There was no lack of sex under any circumstances. But once you've thrown in barriers, suddenly special sorts of processes must be invoked in order for organisms to, in fact, share their genotypes, if only temporarily. In other words, to participate in sexual processes. And so how do you breach these barriers? Well, one of the ways you breach it is via viruses. You can imagine that the invention of the viruses, period, I mean, the existence of viruses at all, is simply to aid in the ability of parasitic genotype to breach the barriers that were put in place for whatever reason. It might have been, in fact, to prevent parasitic genotype from partaking of the phenotype associated with the genotype that actually came to produce these barriers. But we now have not only viruses able to breach these barriers, therefore bring their own nucleic acid into a cell, but it's also possible for viruses and their capsids to carry nucleic acid that belongs to other organisms, such as cells that were previously being infected, and those other organisms' DNA, therefore, can be transferred with the aid of these barrier-breaching capsids from one cell to another. So transduction, which is the virus-inflicted or virus-mediated breaching of barriers, is one means by which sexual processes could be restored following the invention of barriers, and this is a consequence of parasitism. You also have conjugation as a means of breaching barriers. Plasmids, although they can be helpful to a degree, also represent parasitic DNA. Rather than that parasitic DNA moving in a truly autonomous and therefore free-floating package, which is a virus, instead with conjugation, the DNA never really leaves the side, as it were, of the bacterium that it's infecting, but instead these bridges are produced between the bacteria and the plasmid is transferred across the bridges from one bacterium for another. This also is a means by which genes are transferred between bacteria, and bacterial genes can become incorporated into plasmids and then be transferred from one bacterium to another in this conjugation process. You also have transformation. Transformation may very well be a means by which bacteria are able to obtain simply DNA as nutrients from their environment and bring it into the cell so that it can be digested. But in certain bacteria, this DNA is able to make it into the cell mostly intact, and once it's in the cell, it has a potential to molecularly recombine into the genome of the host organism. And this too is a way in which genes can be exchanged between different bacteria, and also it's a way in which bacteria, in fact, can, to a degree, maintain their species similarity, the similarity within species, as a consequence of essentially sexual processes going on between individuals of the same species with homologous recombination in such a way that two individuals of the same species, because they've shared DNA more recently, not just in terms of a common ancestor, but more recently in terms of horizontal gene transfer, will tend to maintain a greater similarity among each other than what you would see if there was no gene exchange at all. In other words, the biological species concept, where you have the retention of species essentially as these common gene pools, where exchange of DNA within those gene pools is a much more likely event than between different gene pools, you see a similar thing among the bacteria. You see it in terms of transformation, where there's a lot of horizontal gene exchange, and to a lesser extent, simply because the potential to breach species barriers is greater. You see it also with conjugation and transduction. But with transformation particularly, you have DNA coming in from the outside world, and to a large extent that DNA is incorporated as a consequence of homologous recombination, which is the kind of recombination that you see in the context also of meiosis, where you have crossing over, homologously recombining the DNA that comes from the two parents that created a zygote. And speaking of zygotes, this is the typical sexual cycle of an animal. And so you have meiosis. So meiosis creates these haploid cells. They are the gametes for us, and the gametes fuse together, process of fertilization. That creates the diploid individual. Now, in this sexual cycle, what you've got is a haploid genome, half of the DNA, more or less, and half of the DNA getting together and intermingling in the resulting zygote. So there's a huge breaching of barriers, an intentional breaching of barriers here, where you're taking the DNA found in two separate cells and putting that DNA into the same cell, into the same nucleus. And then subsequently, in the course of meiosis, you then have a recombination of that genetic material, particularly producing a crossing over, which actually recombines molecularly the DNA between the two parents, and also an independent assortment, which sorts out the different chromosomes from the different parents, so that the result is an intermixing of the DNA of the two parents in the resulting gametes. And this DNA has to be compatible if you're going to end up with ultimately a viable offspring. But the biological species concept, the retention of species as these gene pools where there is exchange of DNA at a high with a high likelihood, but there's a lack of such exchange of DNA with high likelihood with other gene pools, to a large extent is a consequence of the huge degree to which genetic material is shared in this step, such that there isn't a lot of potential for sharing DNA outside of one's gene pool and ending up with highly effective offspring. And if you're not producing highly effective offspring, you're selected against, and therefore you're lost from the gene pool, and hence the biological species concept. But the same kind of thing probably goes on within, for example, bacterial species, where you have some degree of gene exchange going on between individuals, and it's much more likely that individuals will survive if they, following the gene exchange, if the genes are similar to one another, and therefore if they have come from similar parents. And as a consequence, you have a retention of the cohesion of the gene pools of bacteria that is a lot like you see with the gene pools of eukaryotic organisms such as animals, except it's on a much smaller scale in the sense that the degree of cohesion is much lower than you see in the in animals. And in addition to that, the extent to which bacteria lose if they make mistakes and incorporate genetic material that's highly divergent is much smaller. And so, in addition to this species cohesiveness that you see, although it's a much lower level of cohesiveness than you see, for example, in animals, you at the same time see a much higher level of experimentation in terms of horizontal gene transfer, a much greater likelihood of survival of products of radical horizontal gene transfer, and also a much greater ability to experiment with horizontal gene transfer because the stakes in bacteria are not nearly as high as they are for an animal and its reproduction. So there's a big time mixing of genotype, but this demands genotype conservatism among the, for example, the animals, because recombinant products, if the DNA is too divergent, making up those progeny, are mostly toast. That is, they're unlikely to survive and reproduce at a substantial rate or ability in comparison to their parents. So there's selection against hybridization. This selection against hybridization gives you good species among animals where there's much greater amount of species cohesion than you see among the bacteria. So we can define some terms. One of these terms is molecular recombination, which is the breaking and joining of DNA. This is the crossing over of meiosis. This basically takes two pieces of DNA and stitches them together into a single piece of DNA that consists of a combination or recombination of the two parental pieces of DNA. Independent assortment, or as we see in viruses, reassortment. This involves taking chromosomes or segments of genomes and mixing them together, but you don't have this breaking and rejoining. You don't have two pieces of DNA becoming one piece of DNA. Instead, you've got a mixing together of two genomes that each consists of more than one fragment of DNA, more than one chromosome of DNA, and mixing in these genomes together so that the resulting genome contains DNA from both parents, but without actually the individual pieces of DNA being recombined. Gene exchange and gene transfer refer to movement of especially smaller pieces of DNA from one organism to another. Horizontal and lateral gene transfer can have the same meaning as gene exchange or simply gene transfer. Usually, though, when we use the word horizontal or lateral or words, horizontal or lateral gene transfer, we're talking more about interspecific rather than intraspecific sharing of genetic material. Although that's not entirely the case, because when you have bacteria of the same species and you have movement of DNA between those two bacteria that are of the same species, this occurs via mechanisms that can be described as horizontal or lateral gene transfer, even though it's actually occurring within a single species. The same mechanisms are employed within bacteria for the most part, within bacterial species for the most part, as are employed between bacterial species, although the efficiency of transfer tends to be less between bacterial species versus within bacterial species. You can have gene exchange without subsequent recombination or reassortment, and this is what you see with the acquisition of plasmids. It's a kind of horizontal gene transfer, but it combines the DNA from two different parents, but it's not really a recombination in either a molecular or a genetic sense. And so this idea of genetic recombination, it involves either molecular recombination that is crossing over, or instead what can be described as independent assortment or reassortment. And plasmids don't really do that. So in a sense, plasmids are a third way that you can have gene exchange between individual organisms. So when bacteria have sex, this sex involves basically taking small amounts of one of the parents and transferring those small amounts to the second parent, so that the genetic material found from two different parents ends up in the same cytoplasm. And then you typically have what they're calling physical recombination, what I call molecular recombination, a recombination event that then places the snippet of DNA into the host. Now, you don't have to have physical recombination or molecular recombination. It can simply be more of a genetic recombination if it involves conjugation. In this case, you end up with a plasmid that gets transferred from one cytoplasm to another. But you still have the result of the genetic material from two different parents ends up in the same cytoplasm. And then what you need is some mechanism that retains the genetic material from two different parents in the same cytoplasm, rather than the genetic material from one of the parents being lost. Retention involves, for example, this physical or molecular recombination, or plasmids are pretty good at retaining their presence within cells as well without actually recombining into the chromosome of the host cell. So sex can be defined as the inheritance of DNA from any source aside from the parental cell. So this would be the parental cell here, and this would be the source, some other cell. Although it can be free DNA that makes its way in, it can be the genetic material from viruses that makes its way in, it can be plasmids that makes its way in. So there's a lot of different sources of genetic material that can give rise to these sexual processes. And I like to call these snippets of DNA, small pieces of DNA. So molecular recombination, I've talked about that a lot. This is crossing over. So you have two separate pieces of DNA. These can be from two separate parents. And then you have a breaking and joining such that a portion of the DNA from one parent ends up being a part of the DNA of the other parent. And the breaking and joining can occur in such a way that there is a swapping of genetic material. So you end up with two hybrid strands of DNA. This, of course, is DNA. This is the base pairing in the middle of the DNA. So this is molecular recombination. So note the creation of hybrid DNA descending from two different parents. We've got a pink parent and a blue parent. And typically, this molecular recombination occurs at sites of homology, that is, high amounts of sequence similarity between the two strands. This invasion step occurs predominantly where there's high amounts of homology between two DNA strands. And this holiday junction is just giving you, showing you a close-up of what that looks like in more realistic terms. You also have recombination that results instead of swapping of DNA or the replacement of a piece of DNA with a homologous piece of DNA, instead with the insertion of a piece of DNA. And this is simply an image that I was able to find that sort of represents this. So this is the original piece of DNA, and this is the incoming piece of DNA. You can see this red part, there's a little bit of homology here. And this is driving the insertion of this particular piece of DNA. So you're starting out with this. This gets inserted and you end up with this so that the end of this is replaced, or at least the end here drives the homologous recombination that results in the insertion of this tag and marker as well. So this is an insertion of DNA. So that could either be full homology going on here, or perhaps quote unquote microhomology or some kind of partial homology. And this illegitimate recombination can be described as a non-homologous recombination. Even if it does involve a little bit of homology, it's not the swapping of DNA, the base by base replacement of DNA that you're seeing with this kind of recombination, illegitimate recombination. So it either doesn't involve homology or involves a small amount of homology. The important point is that it involves the insertion of a piece of DNA such that you end up with new genetic material. So it increases the amount of DNA or the number of genes found in a genome. Heterologous recombination results in changes in sizes of chromosomes. So heterologous recombination, one example of it would be these insertion events that increases the size of genomes. Alternatively, you can have recombination that results in loss of DNA from genomes. Independent assortments, this is showing meiosis, where you've got the duplication of chromosomes, and then you have the reduction division, and it's during the reduction division that you end up with chromosomes, a mixture of chromosomes that came from mom and dad, in addition to chromosomes that are mixed together that came from some from mom, some from dad. The chromosomes themselves may have undergone molecular recombination crossing over. But if that was considered to be, say, mom's chromosome and that was dad's chromosome, so this is a gamete ultimately being produced that has one of dad's chromosomes, one of mom's chromosomes, rather than just dad's chromosomes and just mom's chromosomes. And these chromosomes are divvied up into the recipient gametes during meiosis in a manner that is independent of one another. So going from homologous chromosome to homologous chromosome, whether mom's version or dad's version ends up in the recipient cell is completely up to chance. So it's an independent event. So this is the assortment of chromosomes, and it's an independent assortment. And this is not going to be much, we're not going to, this doesn't matter to us all that much with regard to gene exchange within microorganisms. Yes, there are microorganisms that do have sex, such as protozoa, but in using meiotic processes. But for the most part, this is not going to be our major concern. So these are products of recombination that you see here. And we have a diploid to haploid transition. That's actually wrong. I'll have to put a little circle with a cross out here or whatever I could use to cross it out. Actually, the diploid to haploid transition happens back here. This is meiosis two. It happens during the transition from meiosis. Actually, it happens during meiosis one. It happens during anaphase of meiosis one, is where you have the reduction division. Here you just have chromosomes that are still in their replicated form, but it's a haploid genotype at this point. So anyway, this doesn't matter to us, but that's clearly incorrect, that statement right there. And that statement's incorrect too, because independent assortment occurs during anaphase one of meiosis. Clearly some past Steve did not know what he was talking about with regard to how meiosis works. Fortunately, meiosis is not a great concern of ours. So genetic recombination does not necessarily involve molecular recombination. It can involve just an assortment or a reassortment stage or phase. But in this particular case, you've got both molecular recombination going on and an independent assortment, although the independent assortment, contrary to what it sort of says here, actually happened up here rather than here. So this is the kind of gene exchange that we care about in this class, but even this we don't care about to a large extent, mostly because we're focusing on bacteria rather than viruses. But nevertheless, in viruses, you can have a molecular recombination, but certain viruses you can have a reassortment. And reassortment occurs when you have two different viruses, each of which has multiple segments making up its genome. They infect the cell simultaneously, and then you can end up with these hybrid viruses that contain a combination of the chromosomes from the two different parents. You can see the chromosomes come in different types, and the hybrids have one of each type, but they've got one chromosome from that parent, in this case, the other chromosome from that parent. And this is a way in which you can end up with recombinant progeny among viruses that contain multiple segments making up their genome, such as the influenza virus. And then lastly, in terms of variations on how organisms have sex, we can look at our standard animal sexual cycle, where you have the diploid going through meiosis, makes the gametes fuse, fertilization, you get the diploid, then you get mitosis to make the multicellular organism. In many fungi, you have actually the mitosis step occurring in the haploid stage rather than the diploid stage. So here you have formation of a zygote. The zygote doesn't actually go through mitosis, it goes through meiosis. It forms spores, which then go through mitosis to make a haploid multicellular organism, which then mitotically produces the gametes, which then fertilize and fuse and then produce the zygote. And then there's our friends, the plants, which we really don't have to care about in this course, where you have alternation of generations. You have a formation of the zygote. Mitosis gives rise to the multicellular plant, which is the sporophyte. The sporophyte goes through meiosis, giving you what are known as the spores, just like you see up here. The spores go through mitosis, giving you the haploid multicellular plant called the gametophyte. Gametophyte then, like the fungi, mitotically produces the gametes fuse, and you get the zygote, and so on and so forth. These sexual cycles are a lot of fun, and it's great to sit down and really tease them out and get a real sense of what they're all about. But again, these are not things that we're going to care about that much in this class. What we're focusing on especially is gene exchange as it occurs among bacteria.